Say, kids, what time is it?
The future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
Well, welcome to Future Now Show. This is Al and Son. This time to you, we are coming from the Laurentian Mountains in Quebec, Canada.
That's right. It's our favorite 2 weeks of the year. We come to Canada. We visit Al's mom. We visit Al's best friends from college.
Yeah.
And we have a great time on Meyer Island.
Yeah, that's where we are now, on Meyer Island. Hal and Steve Sidoroff, are friends from the 70s, can you believe it or not, mid-70s. Steve was my professor at McGill, and Hal was in the class with me. I think it was experimental methods of psychology. Anyway, here we are today. Who would have thought that we'd know each other for 50 years? And that's what it is this year, right? So welcome you guys to the show.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Hey, thanks, Al. It's good to be here.
Yeah,
with
yeah,
all
it's good
of
to
you.
Have you. Yeah, so much has gone on in 50 years.
No, nothing.
Nothing. Everything nothing.
Just slid right by.
It's yeah. A new world.
Well, I'm curious about the world, what it was like when you guys met. You were like a radical professor, right, Steve? And Hal, you were an inventor.
Yeah.
And
student, you were just starting thought technology.
I just started thought technology, and I got into the doctoral program in experimental medicine, and at the same time designed products for my company, Thought Technology, and now it's 51 years for Thought Technology, and we're still going strong.
Mm. We used to sit in Steve's class, and listening to Steve, Hal would be doodling on the desk, and I'd look over to see what the doodles were. And they usually were like electronic circuits.
Yes.
It's our own local Tesla here.
It was an exciting time. I had to design all my own equipment because I didn't have much of a budget.
Yeah.
So I was monitoring like heart rate and respiration and GSR and giving people feedback on that and working with people too. Well, actually, my postdoc was on controlling pain for angina. So I worked with the cardiology department and got really good results with that.
That was in 75, I think, when we were 74, 75 mm-hmm. times.
So what was the state of the art back then of biofeedback? It was kind
it's primitive,
of unknown,
right? It was the first generation stuff.
Well, it had started actually in 67 with Barbara Brown and Joe Camilla, but it really got going around 72, 73. And I went to the first conference in 74.
Huh.
Yeah, there were some companies that were, you know, had big boxes that looked like stereos with, you know, tiny little circuit board in
yeah.
it.
Autogenic systems.
Autogenics, exactly.
Yeah.
And we were using that at behavior therapy unit I was at.
But how did it start for you? I mean, you were kind of a geek, interested in electronics. And,
yeah,
and
I love gadgets, and I went to American Psychological Meeting in Montreal and heard about biofeedback, thought I can build one of those, so I built it into a Scotch tape container with two pennies. For pickups for your fingers.
Yeah.
And I was measuring sweat gland activity, which is basically the opening and closing of the pores of your fingers in response to stress, the sympathetic arousal. Yeah. And I turned that into a tone and the feedback. So then I built it into a block of wood and then finally into a plastic mold where we sold about 300,000 of them through catalogs and to psychologists, etc. It works. It's very, very effective.
That's
very
simple.
So it's
response.
A stress
yeah.
monitor,
right.
huh? Two pennies. They'll yeah. tell it's you like, how stressed out you are.
Well, it's like a lie detector. It's extremely sensitive to changes in emotion. Which is
was
really
that cool. one of the bases of lie detectors? Back
yeah, it is. That and blood pressure and movement. And respiration.
No,
yeah.
It's kind of interesting. You were an electronics guy, and not as many electronics people are interested in psychology. And
biofeedback just crossed right into psychology.
Right.
So
right.
there it was. And then along came Steve, who had a great, interesting class. We had certainly had some interesting people in there. I think you used to come in late.
I'm coming late sometimes.
Yeah, just show up, you know.
Well,
Dr. Future no, can't get there
says,
on time.
What? He says, "What's happening?"
some things never change.
Thanks, me.
He's calling it in and bringing it on.
Yeah, I was doing brain research at the time. I was putting these microelectrodes into different nuclei in the brain and training rats to learn different tasks and looking at their brain activity. So the cells firing and what takes place and where does it take place in the brain during learning.
Oh, so this was an era when brain mapping was kind of new too, right?
Yeah, yeah, very, very new.
Really,
and I was able to determine which areas of the brain would fire in certain sequences during learning.
Oh, so did you make a map of, say, rat emotions, or what kinds of things did you track?
Well, when you bring up rat emotions, this is why I switched into clinical practice, because I wanted to be able to ask the subjects I was working with what they were feeling.
Rats weren't telling you,
and
huh?
They weren't telling
you. Not yet.
So then there's...
Did you ever want to combine those two bunches of research to see what would happen?
That's right. Hal could tell if they were stressed from the sweat glands, and then you could tell which circuits were firing.
Yeah, exactly. What did you find? I'm kind of curious. What parts of the brain seem to be responsible for relaxation, for example?
Wasn't doing all different kinds. I was doing something very specific.
You're looking
in a learning paradigm, and had electrodes in the motor cortex, in the emotional centers of the brain, and in the hippocampus learning centers. And so I could see that there's an area in the brain for recognition, and that would be where I'd see the first burst of activity. And then I would see the next burst of activity in more the emotional area of the brain. And then the final burst of activity was in the motor cortex. So,
what was your hypothesis back then?
Well, it's what I thought I would get, but you know, that's the reason why you do experiments, to see if your hypothesis is correct.
Yeah, I was wondering,
right?
Did you find that you could stimulate different emotions? And I guess that's hard to tell.
No, I was not involved in that aspect of it.
But is this what experimental psychology, was that the work that you were doing?
That's the research I was doing in experimental. Before that, I was studying memory in the hippocampus and different areas of the hippocampus. In Montreal, I was very fortunate to meet and become friends with one of the pioneers in neuroscience, Donald Hebb.
Donald Hebb, yeah. He's one of the grand old men of McGill.
His book in 1947 was seminal.
Have subassemblies.
And the comment that neurons that fire together wire together comes directly from him.
That's great. Early brain hackers, huh?
Right.
That was an interesting environment you found yourself in. There was like a lot of amazing psychologists in that department.
Absolutely. I heard one of Wilder Penfield's last talks that he gave.
Wow.
I sat up in the arena booth above surgery during a surgery, sitting with a guy by the name of Glore, who's one of the pioneers in EEG recordings, while they were recording from a live patient during an operation.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Wow.
And there was also Ron Melzack, who he was actually my internal doctoral examiner, and he's one who developed the theory of pain, called the gate theory of pain.
That's right.
So that's a pretty... And Hans Selye was there. He was on the floor where I was doing my the behavioral therapy
father stuff. Of stress research.
Right? It was a fun time. In Malmo.
And you guys are absorbing all these influences.
And Bernie Grad. Bernie Grad, who... You know Bernie Grad. He's,
definitely influence on my mind.
He's doing research into the effects of healing on, healing water on plants and on animals, and have a healer hold the animal and watch how they heal better when the healer held them versus somebody else.
Fascinating.
That's interesting. I haven't experienced that study.
Dr. Brad.
So they found that there was a correlation.
And the barley plants, the seeds would grow much higher with the healer than with the healer's water than just with regular water. And they can fold for temperature and stuff like that.
Yeah, but what was important about that research is he did double blind research. So he controlled for all of the potential subjective effects and got those results.
So it makes you think, what is it about consciousness that affects, does it affect the water in some way? Or does it store some information in the water that helps heal the
person? Or is it direct from the healer to the person receiving the energy?
Well, if it's going through the water is intermediary, so it must have been in this case through the water, change the structure of the water and
so you don't think that there's something kind of woo and invisible that could have been
For sure.
Well, that's the danger.
The thought that's attached to the water.
The thought that counts.
Only invisible in terms of not being able to measure.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But in terms
it
of
doesn't
experience.
Mean there isn't something real going on there that we're not able to measure.
Yeah. Right.
And so now we know, for example, with heart rate variability, we know that if you and I are standing close enough to each other, I can monitor, if I monitor your brain waves, I could pick up my heart rate pattern in your brain waves.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting.
Now, let's combine that idea with this other notion that if I'm in a positive emotional state, I create one heart rate variability pattern. And if I'm in a negative emotional state, like anxiety, frustration, it's a totally different heart rate pattern. One is very, what we call coherent, and the other is what we call very chaotic.
Huh.
And now, let's take that the next step, and we're standing around talking with people, and we're talking with one person, and we have one feeling, and we're talking with another person, we have a very different feeling. One we want to get closer to, and one we want to get further away from, but we now know that at least one potential source of that experience has to do with the heart rate patterns that we're projecting out into the world.
Elmer Green, from many, many years ago, did what's called the copper wall experiment, where he put people in a Faraday cage and then had a copper wall of copper, big sheet of copper, and he was able to measure the heart rate pattern, the EKG, on the copper wall from a distance of a couple of feet, at least.
Interesting. Wow.
So it just shows that we're always projecting our energy. It's a very strong signal.
How much do we pick it up from each other?
Well, that's the whole thing. It's very likely, because the EKG signal is about 1,000 times stronger than muscle signals that come off of you.
Mm-hmm. Really? So you mean in terms of being able to measure the electricity?
Yeah, it's much easier to pick up an EKG signal. That's right.
The heart, because of the it's more electromagnetic by nature.
Yeah, it's a bigger electrical discharge from the cells. Yeah.
Because I guess the blood in the heart has a lot of iron in it.
Well, I think
it's
the discharging of the neurons, and they give us, you know, it's got to give a shock to the heart, so it's got to be this pretty powerful stimulus.
Right.
Do you think if we all were aware of the heart more as part of our moment-to-moment awareness, like, we would make a difference in terms of our...
You know that experiment with meditators in Boston, TMers, who they got 3,000 together, apparently the crime rate went down, and, you know...
Yeah.
I just heard a report this year that the Kumbhamela that happened in February had a noticeable effect on some other measure of behavior, and that people stopped mimicking the emotions of the news and they were more creating vibrations interpersonally. I don't quite remember what the study was.
100 million Hindus at a party.
In coherence.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is coherence, right?
Yeah, they all gather together in the Ganges every 12 years.
You've heard of the alpha, you know, alpha feedback, alpha brainwave. Well, that was Elmer Green went to India with a big polygraph, a portable polygraph, and he measured some of the gurus meditating, and they're producing this alpha wave, and that's where it came from. When you meditate, you have an alpha waveform pattern. So monitoring brainwave activity is really interesting, and learning how to modify it. There's many portable devices you can do that with.
Mm-hmm. And do you think some of your products are very engaged in that, right?
Yeah.
Well, the GSR is a pretty inexpensive device, right?
GSR is only about $120, but we've got devices all the way up to $10,000, because we can monitor literally any signal.
That's coming from the body.
It's the gold standard, so we can mix and match. You can see what interacts with the other signals and then use that as feedback to control your physiology and be aware of your physiological changes.
Mm-hmm. Huh. And the nature of the feedback, I guess it could be what, these days, it could be almost anything, right? Visual, audio.
Yeah, it's audio, visual, you know.
Initially, I guess it was simple tones.
Well, you can even play like a Netflix and then pause it, zoom in and out, blur it, and you've got to be in the zone. Working with golfers, when they're in the zone, they can actually make the ball go towards the hole, you know, they're putting. Or when they're not, it backs off and they have to shoot again. They've just got to get into the right state.
So you have a device to help them measure when they're in the zone?
Yeah, for sure. It monitors the SMR activity and the breathing.
Oh.
So when they're breathing at about 6 breaths per minute and they're producing more of this brainwave activity in like 15 to 18 hertz activity, it says, okay, you can shoot.
Yeah. Interesting. And so you give them like a little audio signal to let them know?
I've got a little vibrator on the back of one of the devices.
Oh, wow. So it vibrates. It's like tapping them.
Time to go. Yeah.
You know, speaking of vibrating,
yes.
You know, there's some people that do neurofeedback with infants.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And they have them sitting on their mother or father's lap, and they give them a stuffed animal that will vibrate when their brain goes into the optimal pattern, and they can actually learn.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So it's a little bit of entrainment as a way of giving them an understanding of their brain.
It's not
brain.
Entrainment.
You don't think it's entrainment to give them a vibrational feedback?
Well, it's feedback, so it's an operant conditioning. They discover
entrainment
what makes it
is when the stimulus directs the brainwave pattern. Mm. Here, the brain is learning from the feedback.
Okay.
So you basically have to...
Yeah, they're the source, as opposed to an external source that they're imitating.
It's like trial and error learning. Like, you know, the pigeon that pecks and pecks and pecks and then hits the lever and suddenly gets a rewarded piece of food. So then he pecks and pecks and he hits it again. And finally, now all he's doing is hitting the lever. And that's considered operant conditioning.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right.
Do you think in the near future we'll have EEG or neurofeedback unencumbered, where we don't have to have any electrodes? You know, like we can pick up a field around the body. Is that possible?
It is possible. The problem is there's a lot of interference, especially with the EEG signals. It's very, very low.
That's the problem. It's really compared to the heart, which is super strong.
Yeah, and also at that point you get the EKG signal in the EEG and you have to filter it properly. Yeah.
But we might be able to detect auras, and we might be able to detect auras that go into balance and auras that are out of balance, and we might be able to give feedback as a person's aura starts to move into balance.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet, but that's a possibility.
That's a holy grail.
Steve, what was the name of that woman who lived near you that was doing that with high-frequency EMG?
She claimed
it correlated with the aura of the person. You remember what I'm talking about? She was a UCLA professor emeritus.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was many years ago. So she did research. She claimed that there was a high-frequency EMG correlated with different colors in the frequency of the aura of the person.
It was
a long time ago.
It sounds like I've heard of a brain machine that can wear a mirror.
Yeah. Well, Penny Kelly wrote about one in her journals of consciousness.
Yeah, it's more of a realm of dream space.
Well, and it's a projection. It's sort of future check that she's projected.
Some of mind control got into that too.
But the idea is that one of the things in the future, as we refine this biofeedback technology and we can map the aura and our electronic body print in the aura, we can have a mirror that is programmed to read our energy body and then create an aura in the mirror to give us information about our energy body. So definitely something that we could all use, I think.
And aura can make us a picture in a few seconds of that too. This is future. So
now we're talking about grok, not auras.
Aura. A-R-A.
Aura can make a picture of an aura.
Do you see biofeedback introduced into some of these new gadgets that are coming down the tubes in consumer electronics, like the Meta glasses?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. That it would become a standard consumer type item.
Even in a Neuralink. I mean, once you've got the Neuralink, you can use biofeedback as well as, you know, use it to control as a brain-computer interface or brain interface. There's plenty of opportunities for the future.
If everyone is aware of more of their bio-signals, they'll be able to...
Well, I think that's really important because, you know, we were talking about this earlier, Steve and I. I mean, stress is so important these days.
Be able to reduce stress.
Yeah, I mean, Steve's got a great book out that you might want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I just wrote an article for Psychology Today called The Four Horsemen of Stress. And why it's so difficult for people to get stress under their control. In fact, it's considered the pandemic of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. The Four Horsemen, do they have names? They've got to look the same in the
picture. They actually do. So the first horseman is evolutionary mismatch. So we have a stress response that gets activated to every kind of stress we experience. We start worrying, that indicates a danger, a threat. We trigger the stress response. We have a conflict with somebody, it triggers a stress response. We have a time pressure, it triggers a stress response. What's the stress response? It prepares us to either run from the danger or fight the danger. But how many of your stresses can you run from, or can you literally fight? You know, none of them, really, or hardly any. So think about your day, all the times that you're stressed, every one of those times your body is preparing to run or fight. And so it throws our nervous systems out of balance.
The fight or flight.
It throws our nervous system out of balance. The second is our developmental mismatch. So we adapt to the world of our childhood. Mm-hmm. So if you have a dangerous childhood, you adapt to that. If you have a childhood in which your parents may be overly critical, judgmental, you adapt to that. And then as an adult, you operate in the adult world as if you're still that child and you're still dealing with that same environment. You have expectations based on that because you adapt to that environment, and because that's survival learning, your brain networks basically are created and locked in based on that those lessons. Mm-hmm. And so you filter the world through that lens. You pick up what matches it and you reject most of the things that don't. The third mismatch, or the third horseman, is that if you think of most of the successes in your life, they've all been associated with stress.
You know, like stage fright.
You know, you get up to perform, you take a big test, you do a big presentation, etc. And so earlier we were talking about Donald Hebb and neurons that fire together, wire together.
Right.
So that's what goes on in our brain. Those two get wired together. So we are actually biased toward looking for stress in our lives. Because stress isn't just bad. Stress could be very good. Your stress response can help you prepare for your big events, so to speak.
I think of it like a stimulant in a way.
Yeah, it prepares you, but because of these four horsemen, so there's a what I call a stress sweet spot, that area in which you perform at your best. But because of these four horsemen, we wind up way beyond that into the danger zone. And so chronic stress becomes the major dysregulator of our nervous system and of our physiology.
So if you're aware of your feedback signals, your neural signals, you could create real-time visualizations, perhaps, of the horsemen responding to what you need?
First is to recognize the imbalance. Yeah. Recognize.
Can the system do that, or do you have to recognize it? Can the biofeedback AI recognize when you're stressed?
Each person needs to realize
personally,
that they're operating out of these mismatches.
It's all a little self-reflection.
Because it requires an active process of restoring balance on a daily basis and finding ways of doing that. That's what my book is all about, the 9 pillars of resilience.
So one thing I used to do when I was working as a therapist was I'd say to someone, on a 0 to 10 scale, how stressed do you feel right now? And if they go above a 5, I say, okay, you use what you've learned through the relaxation exercise and through the biofeedback to bring yourself down to a 3 or 4. But never allow yourself to go above, because when you get up to a 7 or 8, it's just too difficult. You're already just so caught up in the stress that you get into the vicious cycle. And that happens all day long. You're walking across the street and somebody honks their horn at you, or somebody says something to you.
Yeah.
You keep going up, up, up. And, you know, it's one of the correlations with
and
hypertension.
And suddenly one of the horsemen appears in your meta glasses.
Right.
Well, that's a good use for the meta glasses, to say your stress level now is, please stop, relax, take a deep breath.
How much variability can you have in the signal that you give back to people? I guess it's very variable, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Be real creative.
Yeah.
Wow.
You create your thresholds.
Well, I'm wondering if you can't overdo it in terms of controlling your stress response.
Well, you've got to have a certain amount. You know, Steve said it's a
cautionary tale.
It's a U-shaped arousal curve. So, I mean, you can't function if you're asleep.
Yeah.
But if you're really overstressed, you can't function. So right in the middle, there's a sweet spot.
Uh-huh.
And it's learning where that sweet spot is and being realistic about it.
I didn't get your question, though.
Well, I'm just thinking, I was observing someone who was in a really high stress actual situation, and they were actually so used to managing stress that they were like kind of chill, like disturbingly so.
Like a first responder type of person?
Yeah, like somebody who seemed like they might be muting their emotions so much that maybe they weren't going to pick up on some of the cues, just by habit.
Yeah, I don't think you can mute them. I think if that person looks calm and chilled, under stressful situations, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's something you really can't fake.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It just becomes work when you're in the emergency room. It's like, I've heard of the emergency room, doc yelling, where's the stroke? You know, because they're so busy, they don't have time to really get into the personalities of the people.
Yeah,
and then people just feel like they're just a number to the doc because he's so busy. Where's the stroke? Sadly, it happened to me with my girlfriend at the time, actually.
What happened?
She didn't have the stroke. She was in the car for another reason. We were doing some, like, yoga, and she dislocated her shoulder. And we went to the emergency room at Montreal General. And that's where I heard that. Where's the stroke? And she's sitting there, like, with her arm about it, and there's yelling like that. It was, like, freaking her out about being in the emergency room. You know, I guess today doctors recognize that the environment is what they're saying really affects the patient.
I had a good example. When I was doing my angina study with this doctor, I won't mention his name, at the Royal Victoria Hospital.
Yeah.
We're running people on a treadmill until they get ischemia, until they start getting pain.
Yeah.
And then you have them lie down on the bed. And this doctor comes over, he says, he's talking to the nurse, this is bad, this is really bad. And I say, Dr. C, you're not talking about Mr. Jones here, are you? He says, no, I'm just looking at... I said...
He's like, killing the patient.
He was so out to lunch.
I don't have too much time to live, but no, I don't mean you.
Just so unaware.
No, that's
amazing.
I know, it's that's the thing. We just can normalize it so much, but we kind of would need to be able to be more efficient in our...
You have to be a little more aware.
Aware, yeah. Yeah, in language.
Right.
The technical languages tend to be devoid of emotion for good reason, because we get into our emotions.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So what do you see, what's now for you guys? What's got your passion at this point in time?
Well, so last year I published my book on resilience, and the year before I hosted a summit on longevity. So these are areas very much interested in. I'm currently doing some research with a company that measures biological age.
Oh, great.
So it's not your chronological age, but it's how fast or slow your body's actually aging.
Mm-hmm.
And all the people we're offering to the people who have already gotten their biological age to take my resilience questionnaire with the hypothesis that people who score the highest on my resilience questionnaire will show the slowest biological aging.
Yeah.
Great study. Yeah. Great idea. Yeah.
And then if we verify that, then I have a wellness program that's interested in not only replicating that, but then doing an intervention with my resilience program to see if those who take the resilience program can slow their aging.
That's excellent.
Now, one of the keys of resilience is that you perfectly adapt to your environment.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you interact with your environment in the most optimal way to optimize how your body functions.
Mm-hmm.
But there are aspects of your environment that you don't have control over. For example, you're in a company and you have a boss who's a real ass, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be overly stressful. Mm-hmm. Or you can be in a country where you have a head of the country who's does things...
Overly aggressive.
that does things to create unnecessary stress in the people in the country, who creates a sense of me versus you, who creates environments that are not friendly and not supportive of resilience.
Yeah.
As a result of that, this year... started a new podcast called Quantum Leadership, where the intention here is to help identify qualities of good leaders so that we elevate the level of our leaders to create environments that are more resilient environments.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Improve the dialogue.
Okay.
Improve the dialogue, improve the communication.
Yeah.
Are you looking at workshops, like summer camps?
Well, right now, I'm doing a weekly podcast, and I've interviewed a bunch of leaders, both in business and government, and that's called Quantum Leadership. Next month, I will be chairing a panel on quantum leadership at the Volcano Innovation Summit in Antigua, Guatemala, where I have a group of high-level leaders on my panel, and we're going to talk about the qualities of really good leadership.
Santa Cruz Voice, okay, sponsorship action. Just we'll be back.
All right. We'll be right back.
Cannabis is one of nature's most beneficial plants, and at Treehouse Dispensary, we use it to build community. In addition to dispensing cannabis and education, Treehouse hosts First Friday events every month that feature our community's local artists, makers, and activists. If you're 21 plus, join us at 3651 Soquel Drive every First Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. to enjoy the work of local artists and musicians, find one-of-a-kind gifts, and learn more about the top cannabis products in California. See you soon.
I've got a question for you. Do you want a lower car payment just by making a phone call? You know, most people buy a car and they pay whatever the car dealer says their interest rate is, and they forget about it and make payments. But did you know there is a secret in your contract that allows another company to refinance any car payment to try and lower it? It's true. There is indeed a company out there that knows the ins and, more importantly, the outs on car loans, and they know how to lower your current car payments. It's easy and fast, and you could have a lower car payment next month. Make this free call right now and find out if you could lower your existing car payment. Call the Car Savings Hotline right now. The call is free.
Call now. 800-471-4435. 800-471-4435. 800-471-4435. That's 800-471-4435.
Do never get a second chance to make a good first impression. When you want to make a good first impression, start with Dynamic Press Angelo.
Dynamic Press can take care of every printing need, from business cards to stationery, apparel, mailings, brochures, everything but money.
When you want to make a good first impression, start with Dynamic Press in Santa Cruz.
479-7920. DynamicPress.com.
And we's back.
You're looking at leaders from different cultures and different professions.
Different cultures, different professions. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of leaders from Latin America in this particular panel that I'm doing, as well as Europe. And so we're looking for commonalities, what they all agree on. And so far in my interviews, a couple of things that shine as important are leaders who have done their own inner work and leaders who have high emotional intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
Those turn out to be two key ingredients.
Yeah.
Any examples?
My first published episode was with Dr. His Honorable Ralph Gonsalves, who was the Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
Oh.
And he talks about the X factor. And for him, the X factor is how you draw out the best in others.
That's a good one.
The X factor.
And surprisingly, although I'm happy to hear, he also talks about love and loving all of his constituents and how important that is, and going to the funeral of this local woman who he didn't know, but showing up there and meeting all the people and connecting with them and coming from this place of relationship and connectivity.
Yeah.
And so that's also something that kind of is a thread throughout the talks.
Yeah.
Curiosity is another one. Taking calculated risks is another one. Trusting your vision is another one. And having purpose in the way you run a company, these are all other qualities.
Well, it's quite a brain trust.
Yeah.
Also, huh?
Yeah.
You think the helps of these AIs, they might be able to solve some of the world's problems?
Well, interestingly, you mentioned that because we're now taking the key elements of, I've done 18 interviews so far, and we're taking the key elements and we are creating an AI that can respond based on the the key elements of all of these interviews.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Knows all of their approaches.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so you'll be able to ask a question of any of these leaders in the form of the Council of the AI.
Yes, yes, that's the goal.
Can you explain Freud, please, from a Jungian perspective? Wow. Well, how about you, Hal? What's exciting you?
Well, we've been working on wireless sensors. So for EEG, EMG, skin conductance, temperature, heart rate, etc. We've got a finger sensor called the EVU, which is probably like emotional view. Mm-hmm. TPS, which is temperature, pulse, skin conductance, and it also does respiration, all from a fingertip. And it's got, you know, nice feedback for iPhones, Androids, and for PCs. And we're also developing EEG sensors, small sensors that are wireless, and EKG for heart rate and respiration. So we're busy doing that, and a lot of different software. We're rewriting our latest computer software. So we're keeping busy. You
know? Yeah, I got a taste of that this afternoon.
It's still exciting times.
I was checking out to see whether or not Gemini can really write code.
There you go.
And so what do you think so far?
It's definitely helping our engineers. I mean, they're saying like 80% of their software program are being written by AI.
And then it helps you explain things to him, too.
Well, it just gets it out a lot faster. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Now, I'm curious if you think that there are any trends in either of your work that are going towards individual empowerment, which obviously you're both in fields where you're giving people a lot of tools and feedback, but what adaptations do you find are most helpful for giving people autonomy?
I think that's at the heart of resilience. At the heart of resilience is taking back power and autonomy. Mm. Because when you are growing up, you take on the lessons of your primary caregivers. Mm. And that becomes the ground from which you operate. And in the therapeutic process, and in my book, the goal is to help people recognize that the lessons that they learned and swallowed are not necessarily the best lessons for them. And I like to say that they're grounding outside of themselves, where they're always looking for someone out there to validate them, tell them that they're okay, tell them that they're doing right. And you have to find that ground within yourself, to trust yourself, to establish your own core values. And I base it around a notion of a healthy internal parent. And for me, the healthy internal parent comes from a place of love, compassion, acceptance, support, self-care, and joy. And that when you establish and develop, we all have a kernel of that in us. Some bigger, some smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time gets drowned out by the critical voice, right? Mm-hmm. But if you identify that as the healthy internal voice, and then you keep referring to it, referencing it, that's where you develop your power. That's where you start trusting yourself and coming from a place where I can do this even if someone else doesn't agree with me.
Yeah.
And the more you focus on the positive, the more you'll get the positive. It just, you know, whatever, feed the brain the positive emotions, and that's what you get. The other part of this is, you know, Steve's talking mostly about stress, but I also, there's a lot of biofeedback used for ADHD. It's been really successful for head trauma, for post-stroke rehabilitation and other muscle disorders, for incontinence, and of course, in stress management. So, you know, biofeedback covers a lot of areas.
I guess every organ has its own feedback.
Well, exactly, yeah. And so, you know, you by measuring it, determining, you can do a brain map and looking at the brain and showing that it's deficient in certain areas, and you can improve or enhance that activity through the biofeedback.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Do you have any projects related to dementia?
Nothing directly.
So in terms of cognitive functioning, and in terms of cognitive decline as one gets older, there are a lot of neurofeedback programs that are designed to maintain the health of the brain through improved cognitive functioning.
Well, the AIs will remind you of things.
But you can actually, you know, train specific brain waves to make you focus. For example, as you get older, your peak alpha drops from like 12 or 13 all the way down to 8 or so. And that seems to, there's a researcher, Grazellier in England, who claimed that that's an indicator of, you know, memory loss and, you know, in aging. Yeah. So I actually designed a program a long time ago which would give you tone feedback on your peak alpha. So you'd be listening to a tone and you hear, and you're trying to keep it up there.
By so focusing on the tone?
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. So the brain is amazingly resilient. I did a study a couple of years ago with a group of breast cancer survivors who had chemo brain. Mm-hmm. Chemo brain is a condition in which you have severe cognitive impairment. Right. And these were high-functioning women who lost their jobs because they couldn't concentrate. One woman said, I couldn't read a novel because I couldn't maintain the thread of the characters. And we did a 18-session neurofeedback intervention, and the women said they got their lives back.
Wow.
And we looked at their brain before and after. We looked at their what's called a quantitative EEG. Mm-hmm. So we monitored from 21 locations around the brain, and we showed significant impairment beforehand. Like slow wave brain activity was more than 2 standard deviations elevated, which of course, they're like walking around half asleep. They have too much slow wave activity, but they also had too much high wave brain wave activity. At the end of the study, we almost completely normalized brain wave activity.
Great.
So it shows you the potential, even with people who've had heavy doses of chemotherapy.
So that's a very intentional strategy then. You have to go through a program with very specific steps.
A training program, a neurofeedback training program.
Wow, great. There's hope.
there's plenty of hope. There's so much that we can do with our brains.
What about the system that connects all of the organs? I mean, there's a systems feedback as well, isn't there? Reflect and
I mean, your hormonal system, your nervous system.
You have all this data, but how do you present it in a way that makes sense to us?
Well, that's why if you can bring it in by monitoring a variety and put it into something that's interesting. You don't want to give too much information. You want to sort of...
It's got to be filtered for the right occasion.
Yeah, just bring it down to something that's simple that people can... Right, when they're in the zone, it'll give them, like a movie will play or...
Your cancer program.
Something like sounds or music will play or something like that to motivate the people.
Yeah, there's actually another way of looking at that.
Yeah.
Recently, in talking about how to readjust your stress response to fit with your environment, because I was explaining before why it doesn't fit, I was suggesting that we can engage, like the brain does 100 trillion responses per second.
There's so much going on. Yeah.
But what if we direct the brain in the direction we want for the results we want to get, so that the brain actually does its own AI to come up with the results we want. So my suggestion is that if you visualize the optimal stress response for your different situations, and you keep visualizing it, and you visualize it in as great a detail as possible, the brain body will effort to optimize that vision that you have, that you can actually guide and direct how your brain and body are functioning to achieve that results. And back to my leadership podcast called Quantum Leadership, if you look at some of the quantum effects, you find that those are the things that quantum effect actually suggest that's possible.
Right. So using imaging to set up your preconditions and your expectations and make it sort of call it in.
But you know what comes to mind as you're talking? I'm seeing a combination of the aura mirror we were talking about earlier with, remember the original Star Trek, the medical device that you lay on and you'd see all the...
Yeah, yeah,
that, something where you have all the systems, you lie down in it and you see everything.
that's going on with you. You can filter it for different organs or systems or whatever. Yeah, and the aura would be part of that, that med bed, if you will.
Do you have a question?
I just want to say that, that it's inspired me to think it that way, but in terms of leadership course, I...
But what I'm suggesting is it's more of a biofeedback model.
Right, right, more feedback, not just...
In which your visualization guides that.
Yeah, yeah, where it's actually part of your work.
The interesting thing is that this has been applied frequently in sports. We worked with AC Milan, Chelsea, and Vancouver Canucks, and tons of sports teams use visualization. The idea is you practice over and over and over, and when you get in the real situation, it just becomes natural. This is the way you're gonna deal with it. Or if we had programs for public speaking, where you practice, and you get up there, it's just like, oh, I'm just yapping away to my friends. So you desensitize yourself and develop specific habits that work well in specific situations.
Mm-hmm. Rehearsal for the real-time movie.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
So how do you want to apply this AI stuff to your latest project? How would it make the most sense to you?
Well, very much to analyze the data that comes in. And then, one of the things you can do, which is interesting, is you can break down the emotions into positive, negative, so that you can look at positive, negatives, and good for me, bad for me.
You can sort out your positive, negative emotions as you...
Yeah, you can, exactly.
You speak.
And how stressed you are with that. So that's sort of an interesting way, sort of four quadrants.
Give you some feedback on that.
But also that analyzing the data that comes in to look for patterns. You get a pattern that you can jump onto and you can use for training and watch how it changes over time.
Mm-hmm. I've been amazed using AI how well it's able to distill the key points of each person I've interviewed, each one of their talks, and distill the key points. Mm. Our next step is integrating the key points from all up to now 20, and ultimately it'll be hundreds of leaders.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's quite a brain trust. Mm-hmm. What happens then? And they all have AIs. And personal super intelligence.
Interestingly, this was the basis of neuro-linguistic programming.
Mm.
This is what they did. They took the writings of three master therapists, Fritz Perls, Carl Rogers, and the third was a woman.
Virginia Satir. She lived on the property with them. The NLP was in my neighborhood.
Maybe it was Virginia Satir. It's possible.
Well, also, interesting, there was a couple of people from the university. Margaret Mead was there for a while. And Henry Bergson? No, not Bergson.
But that's the basis of neuro-linguistic programming.
Yes,
they analyzed those three therapists, their techniques, their approaches, and they came up with
integrated
NLP, which is an early version of AI. Only it was done by hand.
Right.
By a couple of guys.
Right.
It was just intelligence. Yeah. It wasn't artificial yet.
Yeah. Right.
Well, now what's happening, of course, is AI is being used by a lot of people as a therapist online, and it was an interesting study done many years ago.
Yeah, what do you think about the therapy AIs? Are they...
Well, many years ago, there was a study done showed that people were more willing to tell computers their real problems than to tell their therapist because they were embarrassed. They tell them they're alcoholics, that they have problems with sex or whatever it is.
Yeah. And you know about this, too, as a therapist yourself? You had that experience as well? That people are more willing to talk to to Alexa than they are to you?
Well, I imagine some people are.
Some are, right?
I guess some people would be.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess a certain percentage. Yeah, they're more comfortable with talking. Like, I know with my mom, not so much in the sense of therapy, but just in being my eyes, like what's in front of me. She'd rather just say that to the machine every so often than rather get a human being to tell her all the time. Mm-hmm. It's a pain, actually.
Right.
As we wrap it up here, I think we should give folks a chance to get in touch with you guys.
No, I need one more question. You were interested in rat behavior and studying electromagnetic stimulation of rats in different parts and seeing what happened. But I remember you not so much for that. And I didn't really know that until now, I didn't really understand that was your focus.
Even though he was in your class,
you
didn't
class.
Know that's what you were up to.
We never showed up till late anyway.
You missed the first 5 minutes, so I gave all of that.
I missed your intro.
Things move fast, y'all.
I'm just sorry about that. And maybe the AIs will help me be able to
Okay, well, what do you remember?
but I wanted to say that what I do remember from you is sitting on the lawn in the front of the school, which was really cool because it was somewhat straight university and you were a cool professor. You know, you were sitting on the grass outside when it was a beautiful spring day.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that about you. And what you were reading, I think, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and integrating that into all this other psychological interest that you had at the time.
What a memory.
And then he also showed up the first year with a red Volkswagen convertible. minus 30 degrees. He could get no heat to the front. He's driving with his head out the window to see where he's going.
I was driving with my head out the window because the windshield wipers didn't work.
And it's so fogged up with ice and all.
Yeah. There was a Volkswagen, huh?
Volkswagen bus.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I had a French Renault that had the same problem.
Mm-hmm. That's
funny. So what was the connection, the Zen and brain stimulation?
Well, it tells you that the goal of all life is greater and greater integration and wholeness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Get both left and right side of the brains working and communicating with each other.
And you know when you feel it?
If you're paying attention. A lot of people don't pay attention. A lot of people are afraid to look inside and deal with their demons and their emotions. And then they suffer as a result.
Mm. People create their own suffering?
To a great extent, yeah. Certainly they could deal better with it.
It's nice to get into nature also. I mean, nature helps you connect. You know, hang on to a tree and go for a walk and go barefoot and really connect with the earth. Yeah. These things are important. They get you out of this concrete jungle, the pavement and the noise and all that.
Yeah, I guess when you're out on your island here.
That's it.
The rest of the world goes away.
Don't tell anybody where we are.
It all seems like a dream.
Yeah, it is.
Well, thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for sharing your dream.
My pleasure. Our pleasure.
So much fun. Yeah.
People can go to my website, drstephensideroff.com. drstephensideroff.com. And there they can download for free the first chapter of my book.
Oh, yeah?
And I invite everybody to check out my podcast, Quantum Leadership Podcast.
Quantum Leadership Podcast.
Right.
Steve Sideroff.
It's everywhere. And Spotify, Apple, etc. YouTube.
Marvelous.
Yeah. Do you guys take feedback? I mean, people can text you or write you on the podcast?
Yeah, absolutely.
You'll read everything in the chat, right?
And you are your thoughttechnology.com?
That's right. So, yeah.
It's
been around for a long time. It's our 51st year.
Yeah, 51st year.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's fun. Still having fun.
Yeah. Well, feedback almost is still in its infancy, too, from the way you guys
become,
talking.
You know, with all the wearables, it's becoming much more popular and people are much more knowledgeable about it.
And viewed into clothing design, maybe?
Well, I've worked with a bunch of different companies on that, you know, building it into the clothing, respiration sensors, heart rate sensors.
Wow.
Yeah. Even like YouTube took a company sold 6 of our EMG sensors around the forearm and made it so it controlled the virtual reality world and then sold it to Facebook for $700 million. I didn't get any of that, unfortunately. But it worked really nicely.
You should hire those guys for your marketing.
Yeah, you know,
good idea.
This is the best thing I've heard.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you guys.
Thank you, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Always great to see you guys. Thanks for coming. The future's calling me. The future's calling me. It sets me free.